Well, I'm Duke. I'm an alcoholic. Y'all need to change your name up here to Roundup / Eating Meeting. I never eat so much in my whole life. I usually tell my story the same way every time. I was always told that you just get up and you tell what happened to you. So I have no idea what's fixing to come out. It could be, I could be a regurgitation. I don't know. But I was born January 5th, 1961. I was born in Las Vegas, Nevada. My dad was a fighter pilot in the Air Force, and we used to move around a lot. And I don't really remember a lot about my young childhood. I'm not really sure why, but my dad was in Vietnam most of the time when I was little. And my earliest memory, I think, was I was laying in bed with my mom. I don't know if I remember this or not, but I was laying in bed with her watching Houdini, and she got this call, and he had been shot down, and they couldn't find him. But my dad was, you know, he was a drinker. Everybody in my family were drinkers. Everybody was drinkers. I just thought that was part of life, My story kind of starts when I was in the third grade. We came through Lebanon, Tennessee. We were supposed to be moving to Germany, and my mom and my dad took us in the den, and they came in there, and they said, my dad said he was leaving, and he'd come back later and get us. Well, he left and never came back, and my mom started drinking pretty heavy, and she was drinking every night, and so from that point on, my family, my mother and my aunt and my grandmother kind of raised us, but everybody in my family kind of, you know, overdid it because they all thought, poor boys, you know, their dad's gone. But my mom was drinking all the time, and she used to take us to these bars, and we'd sit in the back room, and she'd sit out there and drink, and she'd always bring new guys home. But I remember my grandmother and my aunt and them, they used to always take care of us because my mom was not very nice when she drank at all. She wasn't nice at all. One Christmas I was in my room and we heard this noise, and it was Christmas Eve, and we thought, and they were out there drinking, you know. I can remember the smell of alcohol, and I could hear them out there fighting, you know. So we heard all this noise, and we thought maybe it was Santa Claus or something. So we went down the hall, and we opened the door, and there was some guy there with a pistol to my mom's head, you know. And so that's kind of the way it went for a couple years, and my mom's family had a business in Memphis, a pretty good-sized business, and she decided she was going to move us to Memphis where she could go to work for them. So we moved to Memphis, and I guess I was in the fourth grade, I think, or something like that. My mom's drinking escalated even more. So my aunt took care of us a lot most of the time. My mom would all the time she'd pick up anything that she could get her hands on to try to hit us with when she was drunk, you know. But my family's Lebanese, and, you know, I can remember, I don't know if y'all know what ouzo is. Do y'all remember what ouzo is? I used to love it because you put it on over ice and it turned white. It tasted like licorice. You know, we were little, we'd run around, we'd drink a little bit of it, but over the years, it's just, my father, he came through one time that I remember of. Came through one time, and he took my mom out on a Saturday night, and I don't really know why he was coming through, but they went out and they were drinking, and me and my brother were all excited because he was in town, you know. And so we made these mashed potatoes and all this stuff, and Dynasty's on TV, and we were all excited. And then all of a sudden they pull in, and my dad was so drunk, and my mom was so drunk, that they had totaled my dad's car, and they came in, and my dad had thrown up everywhere, and my mom thrown up everywhere, and I was so mad. I don't know why I was so mad. I took his liquor bottle, and I threw it up against the fireplace, and I left with my brother. I was real protecting my brother. And I slept in my girlfriend's front yard because I was scared to knock on the door. But he got up the next morning, he left, and I never saw him again after that. He was a bad alcoholic. Everybody in my family were bad alcoholics. And I hadn't really, it wasn't until after I got sober that he was my hero. He was a fighter pilot. He was this bigger than life figure. I always wanted to be like him. I never knew him, but I always wanted to be like him. I started going to military school, and I never really drank on my own, but when I started going to military school, you know, drugs are part of my story. I won't talk about them, but the first time I drank on my own, somebody gave me a half pint of whiskey, and I just killed it. And I woke up in the infirmary, and to this day, I couldn't tell you what I felt like. I couldn't tell you what I did. But what I do remember is everybody knew who I was. And all of a sudden, I had a crowd that knew who I was. I've never felt like I belonged anywhere. From the time I was little, I've always felt like an outsider. I always felt like I never belonged anywhere. I always felt less than. So we started drinking a lot in military school. Oh, we were really wild. And people in town back then in the 70s, in Columbia, you could go to a liquor store or a convenience store, and they'd sell the cadets beer. I mean, we was in 9th, 10th grade, and they'd sell us beer. And you know, I'd do stuff like one night I got out, got drunk, passed out, and these girls, they gave me hickeys from here all the way to here. I got 350 demerits for them. But for me, I mean, I thought, you know, from the very first time I drank on my own, once I started drinking, I didn't stop till I was passed out. I thought that's just the way you're supposed to drink. And I always thought if you could remember what you did the night before, then you really didn't have a good time. That's just the way I thought it was. I didn't really get in a lot of trouble with it. The first time I wrecked my mom's car and I was drunk, I hit a tree, and I think I lied to her and told her, you know, somebody ran into us or something. She said, "That's fine, I'll fix it." And every time I got in trouble, somebody bailed me out. Never got scolded, they just bailed me out. You know, poor Duke, his dad left and all that. But even at a young age, when I was drinking, I hated my mother, I hated my father. I hated most people in my family. I hated military school. I hated my brother. I hated everybody until I drank. And when I drank, I loved everybody. And I was a fun drunk. I thought I was, anyway. I could dance. I could talk to women. And my mom, I didn't know at the time, had gotten sober in Memphis. And it was probably 1978, I guess, or something like that. I didn't know she had gotten sober. She wanted us to move back to Memphis my senior year. And so we moved back to Memphis, and she was in AA. But she never said the word AA. She never really said that. I didn't know anything about AA, really. My grandfather went through Cumberland Heights in 1975, and when he got out, he had bought this van, and all these AA, old AA guys go around these little towns, go to meetings. And one thing I do remember about that van is back then, he used to put half pints of liquor up underneath the front seat and do 12-step calls, you know. And I thought, well, that's AA's pretty good. So anyway, my stepfather, she started dating my stepfather. There was a lot of these people in here know a lot of people that I knew when I was young. But I didn't really understand really what AA was. You know, I was a teenager. We'd run around at night and drink and wreck cars and chase women and race cars. But I started wrecking cars a lot. And I started getting in trouble a lot. My whole focus every day was what I was going to do that night or what I was going to drink. That was my whole focus for the whole day. And I mean, I was a terrible student. My first question in the first of the semester was, what's passing? And that's what I went for. If it was a 70, I went for a 70. I was okay with that. I started distancing myself from my mom and my brother, and I started, you know, getting with the rough crowd. When I was a senior, I moved out of the house. I just ran away, but I was living in an apartment. And again, my mom and them, they'd just give me money to do whatever I wanted to do. I'd wreck a car, they'd buy me another one, I met these guys, and they were dealers, but we used to do a lot of drinking together. So I decided that I was going to move to Ripley, Mississippi with them. They raised fighting chickens and they drank and did moonshine. That's what they did. And I thought they were my heroes, you know. So I quit school, quit my job, moved out of my apartment and moved down there with them. And all we did every day was just drink, party, run around, chase women. It was a perfect life. And I didn't work for a couple months, but then I got a job with Budweiser in Tupelo. The greatest job in the world. I was the keg guy. And I had a van, and I went around to bars, and I took them kegs of beer and cleaned out their lines. And I was my boss told me, said, I want you to spend a little time with them, make sure they're happy. I can do that. In our van, we would have, it was me and another guy, we'd have a keg right there in the middle, and it was tapped, you know. Sometimes I'd be so drunk by the time I got off work, I had to go to sleep so we could go out that night. But I worked at that job probably about 6 months or something, and I never had a sober moment, never had a sober moment, ever. I mean, during that whole period. Our place where we lived was like a big party place. It was a bachelor. I loved it. We had this big trash can about like this in the corner. So everybody was drinking, and everybody was a big target. And we'd throw beer cans everywhere. And one night we were partying. There was probably maybe, I don't know, 30 or 40 people in our apartment. And so me and a friend of mine were going to go out to this bar, and it was way out in the country. It was one of those honky-tonks. I like those real rough honky-tonks. I mean, you know, the women are nice, and they like to dance and and drink. But we were on our way out there, and it was way out in the country, and it was a real dark road. And I remember it like it was yesterday. We were riding out there. We were listening to Skinner, been doing a little other stuff besides drinking, and we were drinking. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, it was just boom. I mean, real. And the whole front of the car just disintegrated. And I didn't know what had happened. I thought we'd hit some deer. And when I stopped the car, I looked over at my buddy, and his face was covered in blood, had glass sticking out of it. He was freaking out. He looked at me. I had glass all over my face, bleeding everywhere. He was freaking out. And I looked back, and I had hit two guys. It haunts me today. It still haunts me. The visual part of it was, but anyway, I was 19 years old, and I freaked out, and I ran. I just took off. I just drove off. I don't know why I did that. I panicked. I don't know why I did that. I just panicked. So we went back to our apartment, and everybody was partying, and we went in, and everybody in there saw all the blood, and they just thought we'd been in another fight or something, you know. But believe it or not, I sat there and drank, killed some beers, trying to calm down, and I knew I had to go turn myself in. So I had one of the guys drive me up to the police station, and when I got there, they said, "Son, it's a good thing you came up here, because we knew where you were at." And they put me in a cell in Tupelo, Mississippi. You ever been in jail in Tupelo? Very nice place. They put me in this drunk tank, and all it had was just a little window like that. And I sat in there all night. And I didn't clean myself up or anything, and I was just sitting there. I don't think I really registered what had happened. I didn't know what had happened. But in the morning, the sun was coming up, and I went to that little window, and there was one of the sheriff's guys came up there, and I said, "What happened last night?" I remember it, but I didn't know. He said, "Son, you killed those two boys." And the thing about that wreck was the two guys that I hit were black guys. In Mississippi, it was on the national news, it was all over the news, they trying to turn it into a racial thing. It didn't have anything to do with, it was bad. It was bad. So my mom, you know, my mom's family did well. But he told my mom, said, best thing you can do is take him somewhere where nobody can find him. So they had a bunch of stores up in the Delta over there. So I went over there, and I was facing some serious prison time in Mississippi. And the trial and all that stuff lasted for a year. And this is the part I'm ashamed to say, I was basically bought out of that wreck. I'm not proud of that. I never went to court. Didn't go to prison. And after my mom and them came in there and they said, you know, it's over with. It was, to this day, it's never been talked about in my family. To this day, it's never been talked about. And I'm embarrassed to say this too. I mean, I'm going to say it, but I'm embarrassed to say this now. At the time, I was sad and I was scared. But my main focus was I didn't want to go to prison. I didn't think about, and that's the way I've been my whole life. I didn't think about anybody else. Everything was always about me, what people could do for me, how they could get me out of trouble. I thought my family was there to give me money. They had always had. But I went to work for my mom and them over in Cleveland, Mississippi, and I think that's where my drinking went more from going out to bars and partying and all that stuff to staying at home and isolating and drinking by myself. And I started drinking gin. God knows why. I don't know why I started drinking gin. But I started drinking straight gin. And I did pretty good for about a year. And me and a friend of mine decided, I said, you know, I've been really good for a year. I was still drinking, but I was doing good. So we decided to take off to Memphis to go to the pub crawl. So we started drinking Cleveland. I remember on the way up there, he said, man, we ought to eat something. And I was like, I ain't eating nothing because it'd kill my buzz, you know. So we went to pub crawl, and I have no idea where we started. I know where I ended up, but next thing I know, I woke up in Methodist Hospital, I believe it was Methodist, handcuffed to a hospital bed, and I had hit 3 cars and a telephone pole, crushed the whole right side of my body. I'd been there for 2 days, and I would have been unconscious, and they hadn't really treated me. And somehow I came to, the guy that was in a room with me was freaking out because I was in bad shape. So I told him how to get in touch with my mom. And so my mom came up there, and they wheeled me out of the elevator. My mom was standing there. And I'll never forget the look on her face. They didn't know where I was for a couple of days, and she was extremely mad because I was in bad shape. I'd crushed my hip. So they took me out to St. Francis, and I spent 3 months in St. Francis out there up on the geriatric ward. Now, mind you, I was about 20, and it was all old people, and all you could hear all day was moaning. And so I sat up there, and I ended up having, I don't know, 4 or 5 operations on my hip and my knee and my arm. But when I left there, my family, my mom and them, were extremely upset. And back then, I don't think, she came one time and brought me a carton of cigarettes. And back then, you could even smoke in the hospital room, you know, so back then you could. But I had a friend of mine come get me and take me back down to Cleveland, and I was in a body cast. And I couldn't work, but I was still getting paid. And, you know, I was eating pain medicine and drinking. And I guess I'd been home a couple months, and I thought, you know, nobody was coming by to see me. All my friends weren't coming by to see me. So I thought, you know, I'm going to go out. I'm going to see if I can go out to, there's a bar out there, the Greenhouse Bar that we go out there. I said, I think I'm going to see if I can go out there and see everybody. They'd be glad to see me. And mind you, I was in a body cast. So I had a car that had a clutch, you know, it was a 5-speed. So I figured it was Mississippi, you know, you can go, it's nothing out in Mississippi, soybean fields and stuff. So I thought, well, I'll go back roads. And that way, when I had to stop, I can just kind of semi-stop and go through a stop sign. So I made it out there, and everybody's like, oh, man, you're crazy, and sending me shooters. And I mean, I was ripped. But I was driving home, and I rolled through a stop sign, and the next thing I saw blue lights. Like, oh my God. So I stopped, and the guy gets out of the car, and he's like, son, get out of the car. And I can't. And I heard him get on his radio and said, y'all ain't going to believe this. And I said, yes. And I had a girlfriend, and I was still working for my family, but, you know, I was always so angry. And I could, you know, my dad, I thought I hated him, but I really didn't hate him. But I was drinking about a fifth of gin, and my drinking went, you know, I used to go out with people to bars and stuff. I not as much, but they'd ask me to go to a bar with them, and I'd say, you know, I'll meet you there. And I'd drink, you know, a pint or two before I got there. And I, you know, they didn't think I was a big drinker because I'd get there and have one or two drinks. But then I'd go home and drink a fifth, you know. But I decided I was going to move back to Memphis and go back to school. You know, I was sick of living down there, and my mom and them were selling all the businesses and stuff. And so I moved back to Memphis, and I moved in with a friend of mine, and he owned a liquor store, which is a great thing. So I went to work for him while I went to school, and you know, I've made amends to him. But all my friends had gotten out of college. They were married, started having kids, you know, doing the deal. And there I was, still drinking every night, chasing women. And they were mad at me all the time. And I started noticing they didn't want to be around me as much. So I'd lay in my room, and I'd feel sorry for myself, and I'd cry, and I'd drink gin and watch CMT. And I was real bad about when I was drinking, I'd adopt these homeless dogs. And I'd lay up in the bed with them, and I'd drink, watch CMT, and I'd cry, and I'd say, you're the only thing I got to love, you know. And my mom would end up with a dog, you know. I wish she'd get sober, because... but all of a sudden I went from making a lot of money to no money, and everybody started catching up with me, and I was taking, you know, about a liter of gin out of that liquor store out in Bartlett today, and everything started catching up with me. And I don't think I could register in my mind what was happening. All I know is I was miserable, and all I wanted to do was drink. It seemed like it was the only thing that would take it away. And but after about a year I moved back to Lebanon, and my grandmother had gotten sick, and her house was empty, and my mom said, why don't you come up here and live in Meemaw's house and start getting your life, try to get your life back on track. So I moved back to Lebanon, and I moved in her house, and I got a job as a bartender in Nashville. And I would work at night, but I got to where I was drinking about a liter of gin a day, and I'd black out at night. I started blacking out for a couple of days, and after I had that wreck in my, I had, you know, all those surgeries, I'd get in a bathtub and soak real hot water, you know, but I'd get in a bathtub and I'd drink gin, and hell, I'd wake up next day, I didn't know what day it was, and an empty gin bottle floating around. And so my mom, for some reason that day, I've been on a real bad bender. My mom, my stepfather's been sober actually this week, 46 years. And they came in that morning, and I wasn't eating. I didn't drink water, I just drank. And they helped me go to the couch, and they said, don't you think it's time to get some help? And for whatever reason, I said yes. And Bert said, why don't you let me take you to an AA meeting? I said, all right, but not today. That's for sure. And so the next day she put me, I was hungover and shaking, and she put me on the phone with this old timer, you know, and he's like, well, you know, it'll work if you work. You're just such a good light. I thought, my God, somebody check his pulse. Is he alive? He was like... So they took me to this Chinese restaurant that night, and I was nervous, you know, I didn't know. And my stepfather gave me a dollar. He said, all you got to do is put this dollar in the basket. You can do that. Nobody's going to know who you are. Don't worry about it. It's anonymous. Well, my family's from Lebanon. Everybody knows my family. So I walk in the door, and everybody in there go, hey, Duke, we've been waiting on you. Come on in. Whoa. But my first meeting, I said, my name's Duke and I'm an alcoholic, but I think I said it because everybody else was saying it. And, you know, I never went to church, didn't know anything about religion, nothing. I didn't know anything. And the first time I went to AA, I kept hearing people talk about God this and God that, and mentally I would just shut down. I thought, this is one of those cult deals, man. This is, you know, that's because everybody kept talking about God. So I started going to AA meetings. And after about 2 weeks, I was still bartending. I got rip-roaring drunk at work and was on my way home, and I had a Jeep. And I totaled it, stuck a gear shift through my wrist right here, and ended up in the hospital, and that was my 7th DUI. I don't know how many wrecks it was. And when I got out, my face was all swollen up, and I had cast on my arm, and I had these numbers from people in AA, and they said, you know, call me anytime. And so I started calling all these numbers. I was in the hospital, and nobody answered. I thought, these guys are full of it, man. But I started going back to AA, and I started, you know, I think I did what I thought I was supposed to do. That was back when everybody went to Shoney's after the meeting, you know, and everybody was smoking in meetings. So I'd go to meetings, and I'd go to Shoney's, and then I'd bartend at night. And I used to come in there and I'd say, you know, it does me good to watch these people drink across the bar. It keeps me sober. But I had a liter of gin in my car just in case. And I went in one Saturday night and I knew it was going to be a really, 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 really busy night. And I thought, you know, I'm going to do a shot, just take the edge off and kind of get me in. I was living in Bellevue then. And I took a shot. And I woke up 3 days later, buck-ass naked, curled up in the corner of my apartment. I couldn't tell you if I worked. I think I worked because there was $1 bills everywhere, and I sure don't know why I was naked. But when I came to, I made it to a meeting, AA meeting out in Bellevue, and I went down, and I was sitting there, and the only thing I really remember about the meeting was, you know, I was crying and nobody really talked to me that much. And I knew right then I couldn't get sober on my own. I knew that. So I left that meeting and I went back to my apartment. And for 3 months, I drank as much gin as I possibly could without killing myself. I didn't eat. I didn't drink. I was working. I was chasing women. And I had all these people, you know, I make them feel sorry for me. And I'm 6'2", and I weighed 140 pounds. But I thought I looked lean. I'd look in the mirror, and I think, man, I'm looking good these days. And I'd call my friend, AA friends, in the middle of the night, drunk, of course, you know, don't we all? But a couple AA guys came in, and they took me to a meeting down there, and you know, I don't remember my thought process at all. I was surprised they came out there. And again, I never felt like I belonged anywhere. I thought that when I was drinking then, I thought all these people in AA didn't like me because I had gone back to drinking. I thought they were mad at me. And I'll never forget, it was a Sunday morning, and I was in bad shape. And a guy in AA came in there, and he sat at my bar that day to eat breakfast. And I went up to the bar, and I said, you know, Mark, I said, I started, you know, this, you know, trying to, I guess, make excuses. And he said, stop. He goes, I just came in here to tell you that I love you, drunk or sober. And nobody had ever done that before. That was huge. So I drank for about another week and I started doing stuff. I heard this stuff in AA before. You can't get drunk, can't get sober. Well, what the hell does that mean? And I started doing things I'd never done before. You know, I was going to work really drunk. You know, I was bartender and I'd go to make a drink and break the glass, just leave it in the ice, you know, and But I got fired from my job, and somehow I'd made it back to Lebanon, which is about 45 miles or something like that. And I went into an AA meeting, and I went down these stairs, and I'd been in my apartment holed up in the dark, and I went down to those fluorescent lights and all that, and I went in that meeting, and I was sweating. I could barely stand up, couldn't see. I'd had DTs a couple times that summer, ended up in the ER, and somewhere during that meeting, I knew it hit me like a lightning bolt. I cannot do this by myself. I cannot do this by myself. So I ended up going to treatment, and I called my mom, and I hadn't seen her in about 3 months, and I said, Mom, I don't know what to do, and she came out there and paid for my treatment. But I could barely walk, and when she came in and I tried to stand up, it was the same look that it was when she came to the hospital that time. And then she said, Son, you're not welcome to come home. You're not welcome to come home. And when I was in treatment, they didn't do the family program, and I don't blame them. I mean, I don't blame them at all. At the time, I was devastated. You know, I thought I was ready to get sober. Everybody else should be. They could feel what I felt, but they don't. But when I was in treatment, they kept telling me, you need to go up in your room and hit your knees and pray. I go, man, I ain't going up there in front of a bunch of guys getting on my knees and praying. I don't even know if there's a God. I don't know. I mean, they talked about God before when I was in AA, and I just don't know if there is a God. Never even thought about it, actually. So this guy came out there. He was a spiritual, he was an Episcopal preacher, priest, whatever they are. But he was a spiritual guy, and I said, you know, I can't do that. He said, I tell you what, walk out in this field and just talk to him like he's walking next to you. And I started doing that, and I started feeling a little bit better. And I started feeling a little bit hopeful. I was scared to death. I was scared to death. I knew I didn't think there was any way possible I could not drink. The thought of not drinking was scarier than dying. The first night I got out of detox, I'll never forget, I crawled into bed and I laid my head on a pillow. And I was stone cold sober. I hadn't done that in 20 years. I thought, how do you do this? And so when I left treatment, all the AA people that I'd met before came out to see me when I was in treatment. So when I left treatment, what I did was I went to 3-4 meetings a day. I wasn't working. And I sat in AA meetings all day, all night, and I was crazy. Crazy. And there was about 6 of us, you know, and I was just, I mean, all over the place. And you know, I was still selfish, still self-centered, still thought the world owed me a living. I was the most immature. I went into this place one time. I owed him money. I was the one in wrong. And so I went in there and I said, look, you know, I owe this money. And he made me mad, so I started going off on him. And he got up in my face. He said, if you say one more word, I'm going to call the police. And I went, word, word, word. I mean, you know, I'm 30 years old. But I got sober, and I ended up living with my grandmother, and my grandmother was 95, and my grandmother was always the one that bailed me out. She was always the one that gave me money, and she was a night owl, and we'd sit there at night, and she'd tell me about my grandfather that never got sober, and it, you know, he was well-known. But she'd say, you know, your grandfather, Papa Frank, used to go on these bad, he drank gin in a mason jar. And he'd go on these bad drunks, and he'd sit in the backyard and cry. Didn't know what was wrong with him. My mom and them were still, to this day, and I still really hadn't figured this out, and it's okay, it doesn't really matter, but to this day, they've never acknowledged my AA birthday, not one time. Recovery for me has been a long, long road. When I first got sober, I tried everything, my higher power, girls, 1-800 psychic. You know, I mean, I try, because I want, you know, I done just like I did my whole life. You know, I could call a psychic and they'd tell me exactly what I wanted to hear right then, you know, and that's what alcohol did for me. I got immediate gratification. And when I came in, there was these old timers. You didn't talk, you made coffee, you did service work. They were AA guys, AA guys, and I love those old guys. And they didn't put up with any crap at all. They didn't. I got married sober. That was an ugly adventure. I'll sum my marriage up kind of like this. Right after I got married, I looked on my couch, and there was my wife, and there's my dog, and I thought, my God, this is sobriety right here. This is God's will. It don't get no better than this. One year later, I looked on my couch, and there's my wife and my dog, and I said, if that bitch don't get off my couch, I'm But we ended up divorcing. I forgot to tell her she couldn't have a boyfriend. I mean, but after we, going through my divorce, you know, by trade, I'm a photographer, and at the time, I was in the darkroom all the time, and we were printing pictures, and you know, I was angry. I was dry, but I wasn't sober. And I blamed everybody else. I wanted my mom to bail me out of this one. It wasn't cheap. And my sponsor at the time, guy, he looked at me and he said, you know, when you start looking at your part, things will start getting better. And he was right. And I started growing up a little bit when I got divorced, because I was forced to look at my part. And I never have really taken suggestions like people. I always did it when my ass is on fire. I know, and I'm grateful for this, that when I get to a point, and they don't really happen now, but they did, you know, my first 10 years. When I get to a point where I'm so miserable that if I wasn't grounded in AA, I'm going to drink. And it's a bad place to be when you're that miserable and you know you can't drink. When you know drinking can't be an option because you know what will happen. And for me, that's when I had to buckle down and start working the 12 steps. That's when I really had to start buckling down and working the 12 steps. And then I started realizing it's me. It's not them. The world doesn't owe me a living. And I believe even today that, you know, part of being sober is at the time, guys, you know, he does say it all the time, you get sober, you get a job, you be responsible, and you give back. You give back. I remember one time I called him. I said, Guy, I really need to go to a meeting. And he said, man, think about how selfish that is. Think about how selfish. Why do you always go when you need something? Why don't you go enough when you can give back? If everybody just went when they needed something, nobody would ever go. And he was my sponsor for 16 years. And I was holding him when he died. Saw him take his last breath. And then I'd already known Jerry, and Jerry's been a godsend for me. We think a lot alike. He's become my best friend. I don't know how you could ever repay what AA gives you. How do you repay that? About six years ago, I got a call. Actually, it was an email from my father's wife. And she had emailed me. My brother was working overseas, and she'd emailed me and my brother, and she said, your father is dying. He's got brain cancer, and he won't go to the hospital. And so me and my brother flew out there, and I guess he didn't know we were coming. And in my mind, he was still my hero. In my mind, he was still like this big guy that flew jets, and I knew he was a real bad alcoholic. And I'd heard from my brother, you know, my brother had seen him since then, but when we got out there, we went up to the door and knocked on the door. And his wife came out, and she said, you know, he's not feeling good. I don't think today's a good day. And my brother just flew from over, like, well, wait. Well, at that time, this man comes to the door. He was 120 pounds, if that. His hair was greasy and stringy. His teeth were knocked out here where he'd fallen when he was drunk. He looked like Howard Hughes. And I can't even begin to tell you how that felt. And that's what alcohol did to him. And when we were there, he never called us by name. Never called us by name. But we ended up getting him to go to the hospital. And so I came back to Lebanon, and I was in a meeting, and I was pissed. I was upset because he never even called us by name. Never said anything. I don't know if I wanted an answer why he was the way he was. I don't know. But there was an old guy in AA, and he said, you know, and he knew my dad. He said, when your dad died, he didn't know what was wrong with him. And when you die, you know what's wrong with you. And I started looking at him like a human being and starting to understand that things aren't personal. He was sick. He was an alcoholic. And he just did the best he could with what he had. With what he had. Alcoholism, you know, we laugh and we joke, and I deal with alcoholics. I work for a treatment center. We deal with them every day. And out of the seven that I used to run with when I first got sober, I'm the only one living. I'm the only one living to either. Went back and relapsed, died, car wreck, suicide. Alcoholism is a serious disease. It will kill you dead. And I know for me, if I went and drank tonight, drinking and not driving is not an option for me. I'll drink, I'll start driving. That's just the way I drink. The times I've thought about when I was sober of drinking was, I don't think about, well, I'll go down to Old Charlie's and have a gin and tonic. I don't think that way. I think, well, I'll go to the liquor store and get me a half gallon of gin, and that's alcoholic thinking. Today I got an awesome relationship with my mom, my brother. I've got wonderful people in my life. The only person in my whole life that I ever thought loved me unconditionally was my grandmother. And when she died, I still think about her every day. And what I've come to realize is AA people love me unconditionally just like my grandmother did. And recently, I had something happen a couple years ago. I really struggle with getting peace about that wreck where those guys died. It haunts me. I went out to Riverbend Prison, and I spoke out there one night. And for some reason that night, I got really emotional about it. And there was a guy in there, and his name's Morris. And he said, Duke, I'll tell you this. You killed two people by accident. I killed two people on purpose. And the only thing that can change that's a miracle. And the only person that can make that happen is God. And we ain't God. He said, you need to forgive yourself. I didn't realize, even in sobriety, I didn't realize. And of course, a woman's going to make all this come up. But I met this girl, and I don't know, 6-8 months ago. And I've always sabotaged things. relationships and stuff. You know, I can do that in a heartbeat. You know, and I didn't realize what was happening. And I didn't want to do this with her. And I was sitting there one night, and I'm telling you, I don't know what it was. I think it was a spiritual awakening is what it was. And all this stuff started rushing in my head. When I had that wreck and killed those guys, my heart died. I died. And since that wreck, even after sobriety, I didn't get close with anybody. I stayed by myself. And I was an art major in college, but I threw myself into photography. And I think I thought if people saw me for my photography, they wouldn't see me for who I really was or what I had done. I was fearful that once somebody meets me, and if I told them I'd killed two people, every time they saw me, that's what they would think. So I said, you know what? I have got to tell her the truth. She's not in recovery. And so I sat her down, and I just told her the truth, what happened to me. And this huge weight came off my shoulder. I never told anybody outside of recovery about it. And she understood. And it was so long ago. And she said, you know, that's things you've done. That's not who you are. You know, they say we don't regret the past nor shut the door on it. I do regret that wreck. And I regret running. But it's part of my story, and it's what's happened. And I think the only thing that really makes it better for me, I've seen people that same things happen to, and they don't talk about it. And they're crazy. As I talk about it, I have to talk about it. I talk to people that's happened to them, and I have a fear of getting drunk. Because I'll die if I drink. And I don't want to be that way. I don't want to be that way. AA's magic. AA's magic. If you had to tell me when I got sober that I could might help somebody, I'd have told them I was crazy. And the thing that never really ceases to amaze me about AA is all you got to do to help somebody is tell them what happened to you. And I firmly believe that we should give back as much as we can. I firmly believe that somebody was there when I needed help. And it would be awfully selfish of me to get sober, go to sporadic meetings here and there, not give back, not help others, and forget where I came from. I think about my last drunk every day, and I hope I don't ever forget that. But I'm so grateful that y'all invited me up here. I love this place up here. It's spiritual. It's laid back. You have door prizes or have raffle. Love that. I got my mom a Mother's Day present this weekend. That's a great thing. But I think AA is the only place that I've ever felt like I belong. It's the only place that I ever felt like I belong. And I never thought I could have that. And for the first time in my life, I've got peace of mind. I don't care what people think of me. I'm just a regular guy trying to make a living. The world doesn't owe me a living. And I hope that I keep doing what I'm doing now. I hope. I am today, that's for sure. So. Thank you so much for having me up here, and great weekend.